Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue with Archie Brown about what kinds of political leadership work best for societies. Then, how do you heal the children abducted and forced into child soldiering or sex slavery? But first, how have our ancestors dealt with earlier changes in their climate and environment, and what does it tell us about our current situation? With us is Simon Holdaway. He is a professor of anthropology at the University of Auckland, where he also serves as the head of School of Social Sciences. Simon Holdaway is the author of a number of publications, including A Record in Stone, and his more recent one, Geoarchaeology in Aboriginal Landscape in Semi-Arid Australia. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Simon Holdaway. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You've got three primary areas that you've been digging, essentially. Egypt, Australia, New Zealand. Are there reasons why you've chosen these three that seem like they would be disparate, or is there some common theme that you're looking for?
It's a really interesting question, because if you look at archaeologists worldwide, they often really specialize in one area, certainly a temporal area, that's a time period, but often a geographic one too. So people will look at, for instance, the Yucatan area, the Mayan people, and complex civilizations, so recent times. Other people are really interested in hominin ancestors, right? So the Paleolithic. So I guess I'm a little bit unusual because I've moved around the world and looked at people from different geographic areas, as you say, Australia, New Zealand, and Egypt. And I guess the reason is that I'm really interested in certainly the history of the peoples that I study, but I'm also interested in a comparative perspective to try and understand human cultural evolution on the bigger world stage, really, I guess, to do a lot of comparative work, to realize there's a lot of variation in the histories of different peoples around the world.
Well, good. That's exactly where I wanted you to go. So thank you for going there already. What are the comparison contrasts that you can draw from these three very old people, really? The big major differences that you find, as well as the common ground that you're finding.
Similarities. I think it's a little bit of a comment on our way of understanding human past in general. If we look at really coming out of the later 19th century, is this notion that people moved through kind of stages. So we had a hunter-gatherer stage, so people who hunted wild animals and used wild plants, right? And then there was the what people have described as a revolution, the Neolithic revolution, a sudden change with the arrival of domesticates. And then there's another later evolution, the urban evolution, as people start to concentrate into nucleated settlements, what we call villages or towns. And that's an idea that's been around for quite a long time. It really dominates still many of the textbooks in archaeology. But a number of us over the years, a number of colleagues really have started to dismantle, I guess, this notion of sudden and uniform changes. And I really emphasize this uniform notion that all peoples around the world somehow went through this series of stages from one to the other. And it's kind of linked to this notion of progression. So in other words, people who were hunter-gatherers had not yet progressed up to the level of the Neolithic, the term that we use to describe people with domesticated plants and animals. So much of my interest really is to take apart this notion of a fixed progression, indeed to take apart the notion of regression at all, and to understand the variability that there is in the way that people, humans in the past, have interacted both with themselves and with the environments they live in.
And so if we were going to take these three primary places where you've been doing your work, what would you say the differences were in those three? Australia, New Zealand, and Egypt.
Well, I guess sort of intellectually what I've done is to start off in Australia, because I worked for a time at La Trobe University in Melbourne before I moved to Auckland. And my work in Australia was looking at relatively recent Aboriginal people. So the archaeology of relatively recent people last 6,000 years or so, because Australia has a long, long history of human involvement. And I was really, really interested in trying to understand the use of space, so how people distributed themselves across the landscape. And Aboriginal people made use of wild resources. They were, I guess, hunter-gatherers. They didn't have domestic plants and animals. They had the dog, but no other domesticated plants and animals. So they had a particular, I guess, life way. They moved a lot. And we were very, very interested in how people moved across the landscape, trying to get rid of this notion, I guess, that all of existence revolved around a place. And the analogy I use, I guess, is that we go from place to place. So we go from home to work, right? And our interest is in living in our house, our home, and then we get in some vehicle often and we drive frantically, or I cycle frantically to work, and then I'm at work. And so that passage from home to work is something that we kind of do as rapidly and as easily as possible. We don't think about it as a major part of our day. Our major parts of our day are at, if you like, nodes, places in the landscape. And what we've discovered, I really researched a whole lot in Australia, is that perhaps aspects of Aboriginal people's life was not like that. Much of life occurred during the journey rather than necessarily at the place. Certainly the sort of places that we find archaeological materials preserved. So we kind of changed this notion of node to node to think about movement as part of life, that moving through country was very important. And the Egypt project was interesting because we took a whole series of different approaches, different methods that we developed in Australia, and we applied them in Egypt. And the interesting part about Egypt is that we had certainly a record of hunter-gatherers initially. The chronology is a little bit longer, and the material that I've looked at goes back to about 10,000 years ago through to about 6,000 years ago. But at the kind of end of that period, the people that we're studying, the remains of the people that we're studying, they adopted some domesticated plants and animals from Southwest Asia. So sheep, goat, a little bit of pig, wheat and barley. And what we did is to, I guess, use a different approach. People had seen the arrival of those domesticates as very much an important development, one of those kind of revolutions that I talked about before. And we approached it slightly differently, and we said, well, that's interesting, but I wonder if we put an Australian kind of perspective onto Egypt and look more at the level of movement around the landscape. Can we detect that? And we've got some techniques that let us look at that.
We'll just stop right there, mm-hmm. because I'd like to know about the techniques. What are the techniques?
Well, the techniques make use of material that we find archaeologically, and we need to remember that archaeological material is the material that survives. So archaeologists look at a lot of quite unusual things. They look kind of other people's rubbish, but particular forms of rubbish. The rubbish that tends to survive is made out of materials that survive. So I spend a lot of time, for instance, looking at stone artifacts along with my colleagues. And stone's a kind of wonderful medium because people used it. In a world without metals, for instance, without plastic, you need something to cut things up and to scrape things and to manipulate other materials. And stone's a great medium for doing that. And it was very, very important for people for a very long time. But for archaeology, I guess the fantastic thing is not only was it important for people in the past, but it also survives. Reasonably difficult to destroy stone material, often survives in archaeological materials. The other great thing for us about stone is that it's a nice hard medium that people work by flaking. So they strike the stone to remove flakes. And in doing that, they change the kind of geometry of the stone. They take material gradually away. That changes both the volume of the material that's left and the surface area. The useful aspect to that process for us is that we can geometrically describe volume and surface. And the measurements that we make today, of course, reflect the geometry of the stone in the past directly. We can pretty much safely assume that the size of material that we see today was the same size that we saw in the past. It's this notion of a uniformitarian process. So we can use geometry to talk about the amount of material that should have been present, given the size of the rocks that are worked, and the amount of material that actually is present. And we can see that material has been moved away. So that gives us a quantifiable measure of movement. And we've used that a whole lot to understand how people use landscape.
When you say that it quantifies movement, the change in the geometry of the stone itself, or where you find them? How is that?
The combination, actually. So one can imagine a block of stone. If you strike the block of stone, you take off a flake. If you remove that flake, then the size of the block of stone has reduced. And if you can estimate the size that originally was, the level of size change gives you a notion of how much material has been moved away. And of course, where the different material is that you find can be used to
where people have been.
Right. And right. That gives us a notion of movement. So we can actually quantify how much material is moving around, and from that make inferences about mobility. So that's just one example of the way that we've gone about understanding how people use a landscape.
And so now back to this idea of applying what you found in Australia with mobility to your dig in Egypt. What did you find?
I guess the interesting thing, it's a little bit like the analogy I was using about living in a home and going to work. With the development of domesticated plants and animals, people imagined, and there is indeed quite good evidence in other areas of Southwest Asia, so the Levant, for instance, that people lived in villages. So they lived in these beginning of a kind of nucleated settlement. And that's a form of settlement that perhaps strikes a chord with many of us because we live in villages, towns, cities, right? And again, we come back to this notion, well, we live in a nucleated place and we go to another place to do a set of task work, for instance, right? And we can imagine that the beginnings of an animal domestication is a little bit like that, right? So people began to live in villages, and they certainly did do that in some parts of the world, but interestingly, not all parts of the world. So when we looked at the Egyptian material, what we saw was certainly the appearance of domesticated plants and animals occur, but it seems not to have such a very big effect on both overall economy, the people that from 10,000 years ago are using a lot of fish, and in fact they continue to use a lot of fish from the Nile and a big lake that is fed by the Nile, Lake Karoon, that we've been studying. And that continues even though domesticated plants and animals arrive, and they don't seem to change their movement all that much either. In fact, they don't seem to develop the sort of villages that we expect. And a lot of people have suggested, well, almost on the presence of domesticated plants and animals alone, that they must have had villages. So what we did is to look at a number of locations, large number of locations across the landscape, use some of the techniques like I described with stone artifacts to look at movement and say, well, actually, we don't find any evidence for these villages. And I think what that illustrates is that the wonderful thing about human past is the variability. We all are not the same. We have variations in the way that we engage with the environment, whether we engage with the economy, and of course we engage with each other, our kind of the way that society's made up. And we really need to recognise that the wonderful variability we see around the world today is mirrored by wonderful variability in the past, and be careful that we don't fall back into that kind of stage set of revolutions that I was talking about before, to say, well, all of humanity must have gone through this sequence, because actually when we look at the past, we see all of humanity has not gone through that stage.
And some are still, for example, the landless farmers of Brazil, as an example of people who don't live in a traditional village setting,
right?
Even today.
Yeah, and yep. I think that's, we need to really be open to understand, almost imagine a whole set of different life ways that existed in the past, for which we can find analogues, certainly, sometimes amongst modern day peoples, but also realise that the wonderful thing about the archaeological record, that material record, it tells us about alternative ways for people to engage with the environment. And that is probably a better measure of our past than these very rigid ideas about kind of progress, right, that tend to reflect some of perhaps our own
biases,
right, our own culture rather than the culture of people in the past.
So one of the other things I found that was interesting in what you were doing was trying to see how our ancestors have dealt with changes in their climates. And first of all, I was wondering if there was some common ground there, or were they all variable as well?
Interrelationship between people, climate, and the environment is very, very interesting. And I guess it's understanding the level of engagement, because there are a couple of things. Firstly, climate change, because it's so much on the agenda, it's almost as though it kind of happened with the Industrial Revolution. And before that, the climate was absolutely uniform and never changed at all, right? And of course, when you look at paleo-environmental studies, that's absolutely not what's happened. The environment's been shifting around at different scales and different places in a whole lot of very interesting ways. And humans throughout their evolutionary history have engaged with those environmental shifts. So we need to be quite clear that, you know, climate change is not something that just happened. Certainly the sort of climate change that's happening, the rapidity of it's happening in recent times has shifted a bit. But environments have always been moving around, and it's very interesting to see the variability in the way that humans have dealt with that, right? Because we have faced environmental challenges before, and humans have found a fantastic array of ways of coping with that. So that's a major research interests for my group.
So what were some of them that you found in the different regions?
We see major shifts in North Africa, for instance, at the end of the last ice age, what we call the Pleistocene, moving into the Holocene. There's some pretty significant shifts in the nature of the Saharan regions in the Egyptian part of the Sahara, certainly, but the Sahara generally. It was considerably wetter in that period immediately after the last ice age. That lasts for quite a significant period of time, and then it begins to dry out, going closer to the hyper-arid desert that we see today. And people had to adapt to those major shifts, and they did so in a number of different ways. Pastoralism, for instance, is one technique that develops. People use domestic plants and animals. There's also a concentration, as I said, on some of these pretty rich a river like Nile or lacustrine, the lake areas like Karoon, and they form places that people return to. And that's very interesting to see how they use those sorts of resources through time.
And then in terms of New Zealand, could you see any of that?
Well, I guess New Zealand's a fascinating contrast to both the Australian work and the Egyptian work. Firstly, for those of you who may not know, the Polynesian settlement of New Zealand is comparatively recent compared to other areas. Australia's 40, 50,000 years or so old. Of course, the African continent saw the development from our early, very early hominin ancestors through to anatomically modern humans. Polynesia was settled much, much later. Indeed, New Zealand, 700-800 years or so of Polynesian settlement, during which Māori culture developed, right? So the indigenous people of New Zealand. So very much shorter period. But in some ways, there's some very interesting parallels. For instance, the first settlers to New Zealand faced a forested environment. It was almost uniformly forested. Little bit exception, the top of the Alps in southern New Zealand and the volcanoes in the north, but the whole area was forested. The people that came down were people who had domestic plants and some domestic animals. Not so many of the domestic animals made it to New Zealand, but certainly the domestic plants did. So they faced some issues in dealing with this fantastic new environment they'd found. Very, very rich marine resources, as there are today in New Zealand. You can imagine that in the past there would have been even more so. But coping with a different environment outside island Polynesia from where they came was a challenge. So people met that challenge in a number of different ways, established early settlements, and needed to pretty rapidly deal with the fact that they had kumaro, which is a Māori name for a sweet potato, which they needed to cultivate, which they did fast. So understanding how people interact with those early environments is important. Mobility, it turns out, is also important for New Zealand. We've got very good evidence from the sort of stone sources, the same stone artifact things again, that people were accessing a wide range of sources from all over New Zealand very early in these sites. So obviously people are moving around a great deal. So we come back to this notion, do they establish this almost European vision of a village and kind of surrounding areas, almost in a kind of medieval way? And I think that the evidence is pretty clear that they didn't. They had unsurprisingly, yet another take on how to deal with this new environment with domesticated plants and this fantastic marine resource. And they moved around a great deal, as we can see archaeologically.
Right. So in terms of the things that you found, I was reading one article that said that one of the pieces of evidence was dog poop. Is this something that is a common type of evidence that you would analyze?
I guess it's interesting, isn't it? The domestic dog is one of the animals that did make it to New Zealand. But I guess the interesting thing about archaeology is not to concentrate necessarily on single artifacts. So, you know, a lot in the movies you see the archaeologist grabbing the artifact out of some place, right? And this provides the answer to more or less everything, right?
But it's really a lot of puzzle pieces.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we're looking at is really the mundane material that was left behind by people for a variety of reasons in different contexts. And one of the interesting things is to try and work out why material was left. Certainly, a lot of it is material that's no longer used. It's just not useful particularly. People may have reused it occasionally, but eventually it falls out of the system. Other material is perhaps lost sometimes or abandoned for a variety of different reasons. And to understand the context of the material that we find and the range of material is very important. So certainly dog poo is interesting because it tells you what the dog has ate, right? One of the areas that we're very interested in researching is if we can get some paleo DNA, that's some ancient DNA, from the interior of the dog poo. Sort of somewhat bizarrely, you can think of the dog poo as a kind of capsule of material that is relatively well protected from material coming from outside. So, you know, one of the issues about getting ancient DNA is to keep it kind of protected from contamination. And the sort of DNA that we're interested in is not really so much dog DNA. We know it's from dogs, but we're interested in what the dogs ate. And we're particularly interested if the dogs ate, for instance, the sweet potato, the kumara that I mentioned, right? Because finding early evidence of that can be quite difficult. So if they consume that and we can pull that DNA out. We have not managed to achieve that yet, but it's one of our research interests, right?
One of the other things that was noted in, I think this was in the New Zealand Herald, was that you tend to avoid places that are in conflict or about to go into conflict, but you've been in Egypt quite a bit. How did you deal with the Arab uprising that was going on?
Well, we kind of didn't deal with it, actually.
You didn't.
So, you know, one of our...
You left.
Oh, yeah, we were not there during that time. And we're very, very careful. You know, we all work for a university and our primary concern is the health and safety of our people, right? And particularly, obviously, our students, but also the staff members they take with us. So we do pretty careful.
So did you have to abandon that dig after the uprising?
We've been back once, yeah, when it was safe, but we haven't been going there when there was any issues that might impinge on our staff. Yeah, we don't do that. Obvious reasons, you know. There's a lot of archaeology around the world. And
those of us that are political scientists, by the way, we go to the conflict zones.
Right. I guess I look at it as, you know, there's a lot of interesting places to research. And we research those places where we have good agreements with local people, indigenous groups, very important. It's an absolute priority to get permission and indeed the cooperation of and the involvement of indigenous groups where we work. We just don't work otherwise. So, you know, that's a really important ethical aspect to archaeology worldwide.
So you've got this deep history that most of us don't have, much deeper than historians. It just goes back and back. How do you think that shapes your ideas about humanity?
That's a really interesting question. I guess for me over the years, what's really struck me is the variability in response of different cultural people at different times in different places. Sure, there's some commonalities about the way people went around things some of the time, but it's the fascinating diversity. And, you know, there's a lot of attempts, I guess, amongst all of us to go for the big answer. Oh, it's because there's environment change or technological evolution or happenstance, and people are saying, well, that's the reason that such and such a change happened, and this explains the cultural or historical background of a particular people. And, you know, the more you study the deep past, as you point out, and in different regions, the more you realize that that one explanation really isn't going to cut it. It's the wonderful diversity of interaction between people and other people, people in the environment, people in the material culture that they developed. It's that real complexity in the context, in the historical context where we find it. That is the story of humanity, rather than this drive to explain everything by single processes.
Yeah. Now, in modernity, and that we are dealing with climate change and we are dealing with conflict, and probably some similarities as what our ancestors have dealt with, does it give you some sense of how we've evolved, or if we have really evolved, or are we seeing kind of just very minor shifts in what humanity has become?
I think it very much depends what we mean by evolution. And we can define and talk about evolution in a whole lot of different ways, biological evolution, cultural evolution, right? We can use it as a kind of pretty strict Darwinian concept. We can use it as a more general analogy. And I think perhaps the word gets bandied around a lot with those definitions merging into each other. And that's probably not the best to kind of look at. I certainly think that looking at all this diversity, probably the first thing is to understand the diversity, that the way that one group acts is not necessarily the way another group acts. And to get understanding, the more people realize that there's a lot of different ways of approaching problems and the history of approaching problems leads to a whole lot of different solutions, the better we are. Going in with this, well, the model works in my backyard, therefore it will work in somebody else's backyard, is probably not one that's sustained much by the sort of material I've looked at, right?
Simon Holdaway, great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle.
It was a pleasure.
Simon Holdaway is a professor of anthropology at the University of Auckland, where he also serves as the head of School of Social Sciences. Simon Holdaway is the author of a number of publications, including A Record in Stone, and his more recent one, Geoarchaeology in Aboriginal Landscape in Semi-Arid Australia. When we come back, we continue with Archie Brown about what kinds of political leadership work best for societies. This is part two of that discussion. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Strong leaders are not necessarily good for societies, or so our next guest says. Archie Brown's comprehensive study on leadership suggests that so-called strong leaders make catastrophic mistakes that tend to cost lives. Archie Brown is professor emeritus at Oxford University, and his latest book is called The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. Welcome, Archie Brown. It's great to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
It seems like in democracies, you have more of the category of redefining leaders. You have quite a few examples of those. Let's talk about them.
Yes, I mean, in transformational leaders, I think it's easier to find them in authoritarian regimes, people like Gorbachev, who transformed the Soviet political system, or Deng Xiaoping, who played the leading role in transforming the Chinese economic system. But in a democracy, yes, there are people who I think can fairly be called redefining leaders. They redefine what's possible within their country. They move the center in their direction rather than simply seeking out the center ground and planting themselves firmly within it. They move the center to the left or to the right. But in any case, they change understanding of what is possible within that country. And the two examples I pick out in the United States are Franklin D. Roosevelt, not surprisingly, with the New Deal, which introduced more governmental intervention in the American economy than was normally thought to be decent in the United States, and Lyndon Johnson for his civil rights legislation and war on poverty. He fared disastrously in foreign policy with the Vietnam War, but in domestic policy, he really was a redefining leader, and some of what he achieved has been of lasting significance, especially widening the suffrage to people who had been unfairly denied the vote in many southern states.
You've pointed out aptly that Americans in particular expect too much from the president.
In the United States, there are tremendous expectations of the president. And, you know, given the constraints on the president from, you know, things I mentioned, the Congress, judiciary, the lobbies, then it's quite unrealistic. I think expectations were especially high in the case of Barack Obama because he was such a brilliant campaigner and he really did inspire a lot of people on his way to the White House in the first place. But then he inherited a very difficult situation abroad, especially in the Middle East. And relations with Russia, of course, have been difficult, and that's partly because of the way internal developments in Russia have gone. It would have been difficult for any president to establish good relations with Putin's Russia. And then domestically, a full-blown economic crisis. So the expectations, I think, especially in retrospect, were unrealistically great.
Where would you put Ronald Reagan?
Well, Ronald Reagan, I think, was not really a redefining leader. He certainly was successful in the sense that he made people feel better about America again. His sunny optimism definitely struck a chord with many Americans. He was very lucky in the fact that Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union in March 1985, because we tend to forget that there were four Soviet leaders who overlapped with Reagan: Brezhnev, Andropov, Chernenko, then Gorbachev. And absolutely nothing changed for the better in East-West relations or in Eastern Europe or in the Soviet Union during the leadership of those first three. So, you know, it was the Gorbachev coming to power that was decisive for the change in Soviet foreign policy and, you know, ultimately the whole of Eastern Europe becoming non-communist and independent.
You also have South Africa in your book, and you had, of course, Nelson Mandela as transformational and F.W. de Klerk as maybe redefining.
I think de Klerk does deserve some credit for realizing that the apartheid regime couldn't go on as it had done. Again, the changes in the Soviet Union were relevant because the card that the supporters of apartheid had kept playing in South Africa was the fear of communism. And the African National Congress, you know, included many communists and others who were sympathetic to the Communist Party. So as long as there was a Soviet Union there and they could be portrayed as somehow being allies of the Soviet Union, then there were people in the outside world who were prepared to tolerate the apartheid regime. But with the changes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe becoming non-communist, he couldn't play the anti-communist card any longer. And the support both within South Africa from the overwhelmingly larger black population and from outside was becoming ever more pressing. So he recognized that and made overtures to Nelson Mandela. But Mandela was the transformational leader, because insofar as South Africa has made a peaceful transition, relatively peaceful transition, from minority white rule to majority rule, it was through Mandela's extraordinary magnanimity and his inclusive style. And, you know, he finished up with something inconceivable, the Afrikaner population admiring him, not just respecting him, but, you know, even loving him. So that was quite remarkable. And he also served only one term as president. In a continent with far too many presidents for life, you know, he had the good sense to stand down after one term as president.
And you talked about the Brazilian leader, Fernando Henrique Cardoso. What about him?
Cardoso, again, I think, was a remarkable leader. I mean, probably transformational, at least redefining, that, you know, he really established democracy on a firm foundation in Brazil. And again, he was inclusive. He got the trade unions on his side in order to curb inflation and persuaded them that, you know, high inflation was not in the interests of workers. So I think, you know, both in terms of democracy building and in terms of his economic policy, he was a remarkable leader.
What about Taiwan?
Taiwan is an interesting case, because, you know, Chiang Kai-shek's son was the person who really laid the groundwork for democracy. Again, there were external influences. The fact that the United States was beginning to improve relations with communist China made him realize that Taiwan's position was going to be stronger in the outside world if it became more democratic, and so he instituted democratic reforms.
When we look through all of these leaders, and we think about what kind of leaders we want, you used a quote from Lao Tzu that leadership is best when we barely know that the leader is there. Do you think that's true?
It's an interesting statement. I think it's sometimes the case that when a leader has quite a low profile but still, you know, achieves things through others, that's you know, very fine kind of leadership. But at other times, you know, you do have to see the leader playing a more prominent role. But on the whole, I think, you know, we go to the other extreme. We obsess about the individual leader. I mean, in Britain, you know, all the time people are writing about the political divide in terms of Cameron and Miliband, and far too much attention paid to those two individuals. The more you expect one individual to do, whether leader of a party or not, you know, the less time that individual has to focus on each of the issues. And so it is really a huge mistake to try to pile more and more on their agenda and ask them to decide. So I much prefer the Clement Attlee style of leadership, in which ministers had tremendous authority within their own departments, but on really big issues of principle, they had to get the agreement of the collective, of the cabinet, and Attlee presided over that cabinet, but didn't try to thrust his opinion down the throats of his colleagues. That, for me, is a better style of leadership.
On the U.S. side of that, you pointed out that Truman was a bit that way.
Yeah. Yes, I think Harry Truman, one couldn't say he was a redefining leader or still less a transformational leader, but he was an effective leader. And I think there's no doubt that the greatest achievement of the Truman administration was the Marshall Plan. I mean, that really was responsible probably for saving democracy in Europe, not only saving it from economic collapse, but, you know, at a time when communist regimes were rising in Europe, it also underpinned democracy. And the prime mover was, of course, Secretary of State George Marshall. But, you know, Truman was happy for Marshall to take most of the credit. Another leader might have wanted to call it the Truman Plan. I know there was a Truman Doctrine, but the Truman Doctrine wasn't as important as the Marshall Plan. That was undoubtedly the greatest achievement of his administration. And it's quite right, and Truman was suitably modest in accepting that it should bear the name of Secretary of State Marshall.
You pointed out that he was also a very reluctant leader, and that this is something that our Greek philosophers have pointed out that perhaps should be one of the defining characteristics of a good leader.
Yes, when somebody said to him that he'd shown he'd rather be right than president, he said he would rather be anything than president. That's pretty unusual for somebody who comes to the top in any political system. But it may not be such a bad characteristic. In Britain, there was pressure for a minister who resigned, Alan Johnson, who has written a very good book about his poverty-stricken childhood, to become leader of the Labour Party, and he said he wouldn't, under any circumstances, stand for election as leader of the Labour Party. So one or two people wrote letters to newspapers saying, well, this is exactly the kind of leader we need, somebody who doesn't want to be leader. So there is something to be said for it. But I think, on the whole, even though I take the line I do, I think it would be going too far to say that modesty must be a characteristic of a head of government.
What are the other characteristics that you think we need in a good leader?
Well, the ones I pick out are integrity, intelligence, collegiality, shrewd judgment, a questioning mind, willingness to seek alternative views, ability to absorb information, if we're lucky, vision, courage, flexibility, good memory, articulateness, empathy, great energy. That's quite a list, and we wouldn't expect any individual leader to incorporate all of them.
It does seem that we expect them to incorporate all of them and to be strong when they have to be strong, too. Do you think we expect too much?
I think we do expect too much, and I think that, you know, we should be beyond the stage where we look to achieve, you know, as if we're a primitive tribe. We need to achieve to tell us what to do. We should, you know, be more willing to spread the load and for individuals within a leadership to exercise their own leadership and not look just to one person at the top. It seems to me to be neither sensible nor appropriate within a democracy.
The other thing I wonder sometimes when I think about this focus on individual leaders is that we don't really focus enough on processes, systems, institutions, social forces, and trying to understand why things are the way they are. Would you think that's accurate?
Well, this is certainly true that, you know, part of the obsession with leadership is an obscuring of the social forces you mentioned. I mean, the power of money in American politics and American elections is unusually great, and certainly one could argue that it's inappropriately great for a democracy. So, you know, simply obsessing about, you know, whether A or B will be the next president may be obscuring more fundamental issues.
A characteristic that you wrote about that maybe a leader should not have is hubris.
Yes, I mean, the longer they remain in office, the more inclined they are to think that they're always right. And, you know, when Margaret Thatcher died, people said, well, she was a conviction politician, but one of her convictions was that she was always right. And, you know, eventually her colleagues got fed up with that, and her own cabinet turned against her and told her she couldn't go on. It happened to Tony Blair as well. So the United States may well be right in restricting presidents to two terms of office. In a parliamentary system, you can normally go on longer than that if your colleagues will put up with you, and the electorate will as well. But there is a real danger for politicians who stay in office too long. Greater, of course, in authoritarian regimes where people are even more deferential to the leader and they're afraid of the leader very often because the leader has such control over their lives that then they, too, suffer from hubris.
Where did you think the President George W. Bush belonged?
Well, President George W. Bush was certainly not a redefining leader. And I would argue he was rather an unsuccessful leader. that he certainly didn't meet a number of the criteria which I mentioned, which would include, you know, high intelligence, articulateness, and so on. And he made a monumental mistake, in my view, at the time of the Iraq War. He probably, being inexperienced in foreign policy, listened too much to some of the people in his entourage. So in that sense, he wasn't an especially strong leader, though he makes a great point in his memoirs about how he was the decider. Well, perhaps he took the ultimate decision, but a lot of the groundwork pointed in a particular direction, and that was the direction of military intervention in Iraq. And it's very easy to destabilize a country if you use America's vast military power. It's very much harder to control what the subsequent repercussions will be.
When you looked over the course of the 20th century, which was the focus of this book, have you noticed patterns in terms of how leadership has changed over that century and into the 21st century?
One of the most important changes is, of course, the advent of television and now all the social media. But it is the case that a leader who is hopeless on television is unlikely to do very well now in a democracy. So you really need to add that to the list of attributes that a leader has to have, that he can be reasonably persuasive and presentable on TV. And, you know, the 24/7 media means that the extent to which the leader is under constant examination is far greater. When Stanley Baldwin was British Prime Minister, this is in the 1930s, he got into a railway carriage and somebody who had been at school with him asked him what he was doing now. His photograph was occasionally in the papers, but there was no TV. So if somebody was inattentive to politics, they could be unaware that the person was Prime Minister. So that's a big change. Some people say Attlee, the post-war Labour government, the Labour Prime Minister, could not have been so successful today because he was somebody who would never use two words when one would do, and he might not have come over so well on TV. I don't know, but that's certainly a change. The mass media have affected the way in which leaders are perceived, and they've also personalized it even more than it was before, and they've focused increasingly on the person of the top leader rather than the team.
The other aspect of leadership that you point out is how we tend to evaluate them. You warn against this sort of dichotomies when we're thinking about leaders. They're good, they're bad, they're strong, they're weak, that there is this oversimplification on our part. What is the cost of this oversimplification, and how can we adjust our thinking?
Well, I think, you know, these dichotomies are terribly misleading, and especially the strong, weak one, because it leads a leader to want to show that he's strong or she's strong, and instead of considering the policy in the round and bringing in all your colleagues and acting collegially, you've got to demonstrate strength. That tends to mean then that you take policy decisions yourself and then may exclude people who should be involved in them because you're wanting to show how strong you are. So I think that strong, weak way of judging leaders is especially dangerous. But, you know, leadership is a complicated thing, and it depends on the context, and foreign policy and economic policy can be leading in different directions. A leader should simply not try to hoard power and do everything himself or herself. I mean, Margaret Thatcher once in the cabinet said, "Why do I have to do everything myself in this government?" Well, of course, she didn't need to. There were perfectly capable people around the table, but she'd come to believe that she had to.
The other aspect, I think, of this media age that you pointed out is this sort of cult of personality that has emerged, where it's just blinded to everything except for this very monolithic view of a leader.
Yes, I'm very much against the cult of personality in democracies, as well as still more obviously in authoritarian regimes. Now, Adlai Stevenson once said, the way things are going, you know, we'll finish up with an actor as president. Well, not very long after they had an actor as president, and he wasn't exactly a failure either. But the cult of personality, I think, is damaging for democratic politics. In a democracy, we should believe that people as a whole have a right to influence decisions, and there should be a group of people in government who share power. The idea that one person knows best, I mean, that should have died out with the divine right of kings.
So in the end, after doing this analysis over all the years that you have done this analysis, in the grand scheme of things, given institutions and given processes and routines and all of these forces that make governance work, how important is the head of government leader?
Well, there's no getting away from the fact that the head of government matters. The head of government sets the tone of the government, even if they don't do everything themselves or try to do everything themselves, and they certainly shouldn't. They're bound to be very influential in setting the tone. And so, you know, the difference between an Attlee and a Thatcher in Britain, or the difference between a Reagan and a Johnson. I mean, Reagan was hands-off to a remarkable extent. Johnson was very much hands-on. So, yes, there's no getting away from the fact that the leader is important, and still more in the United States in the sense that the president is the executive in a way in which a prime minister in a European democracy is not. All executive power is not vested in the prime minister. But then against that, of course, you've got the countervailing powers in the United States. I know, I certainly wouldn't wish to deny that the head of government is a very important person.
Archie Brown, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Pleasure.
The book again is called The Myth of the Strong Leader. When we come back, how do you heal the children abducted and forced into child soldiering or sex slavery? Up next, stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. What becomes of the children abducted and forced into sex slavery and child soldiering? Our next guest is helping them heal and rebuild their lives. Jane Akaya is a therapist and the founder of Children of Peace Uganda. Welcome, Jane Akaya. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Maria.
Most people know a little bit about what has been going on in Uganda with the Lord's Resistance Army, but they don't know the scope of it and the details of it. Can you give us a sense of how dire the situation was and what it's like today?
The LRA rebellion led by one Joseph Kony started way back in 1988. And I think he felt just dissatisfied with maybe what the government of Uganda was doing. And then he started this rebellion. He felt maybe the leadership should have been based on religious beliefs. And yet Uganda has so many other religions. So for him, he felt that's what he wanted. And yet the reality on the ground is that what he was doing and what he's doing right now does not relate to any religious principles at all. So it started just as a small movement and then it grew so large. Initially, he would talk to people and people thought, oh, maybe he was a good person. Then eventually when he realized that people were not buying his ideologies, he started abducting children. He would maybe break into a school and abduct any number of children, regardless of the age. He would break into people's houses, maybe the whole village in the night. And he takes little children, even as young as 5-year-olds. And he walks them into captivity, into the bushes of northern Uganda. The children really get so enslaved in captivity. The children are trained as child soldiers. The girls are given out as the sex slaves to the commanders. They are also trained as soldiers. The children are definitely forced to do unthinkable things that anyone cannot imagine. They have to walk lots and lots of distance without food, without water. And according to the children that we would receive, a child can go even for 3 days or 5 days without any food and any water. And yet they are carrying lots and lots of luggage. Definitely most of the children died on the way. That went on from 98 up to around 2006. When eventually people tried to negotiate. But even so, there were some peace negotiations that the government tried with the Lord's Resistance Army rebels, but they never really materialized. As a result, according to the World Bank report of 2007, the number of the children and the youth who were abducted in northern Uganda alone is put at 66,000 children.
How many have survived, do you think, of that?
Oh, the ones who have survived and have returned home could be maybe something like 20,000 only. That's a very, very low number compared to the children that got abducted. I have personally worked with children who were forced to kill their parents before they were abducted. I've worked with children who are forced to kill their own siblings. I have worked with children who are you know, some of the things is just difficult to mention in air. But unthinkable atrocities like forcing children even to eat human flesh. That's how terrible the LRA is. They do things that you cannot imagine another human being would do to another human being, leave alone a child.
With what you've described in your own website as a relative peace, mm-hmm. are children still at big risk of being abducted like this?
Oh, in Northern Uganda right now, no. But even as we know, the LRA, after they tried peace talks, the Juba peace talks in 2007, and of course, which flopped in 2008, 2009, because the LRA was not cooperating. That time, there was a truce that was given to the rebels to cross to Sudan for the peace talks. So the government of Uganda then with other friends helped to block the way. So they are not abducting children in Northern Uganda right now. But the abductions are continuing in the DRC, in Congo, and then in the Central African Republic. And that's a great concern for us because we know how much the LRA created a lot of damage in our children in Northern Uganda. And we feel the pain because we know what he did in Northern Uganda is what he's duplicating in other countries. And that's so terrible.
So your organization is now working to help these children, and now some of them I'm sure are adults, mm-hmm. to heal their own trauma and to rebuild their lives. How many have you worked with so far? How difficult is this task?
I personally worked with the Raquel Rehabilitation Center, where over 3,000 children as they returned from the LRA captivity. What I personally do is I set up a nonprofit because when the center closed down, the Raquel Center, that was towards the end of 2006, I knew inside my heart that the work that we had done at the center was emergency kind of response. I usually call it first aid. We had only given the children and the youth first aid. An accident victim cannot recover from that. We knew these children could not recover from that. So I personally decided to follow up the children to the communities because we reunited them with their families and others with relatives, those especially
the ones who still had families.
Yeah. So what we are doing right now as Children of Peace Uganda is follow the children to the community, identify their different needs on an individual basis, and see how do we support them, how do we empower them to become self-reliant adults in the near future.
And what are some of the things that you're doing with them? I saw that some of the activities deal with using drama, using mm-hmm. art. What is working, and what are the results that you're seeing?
We are using a holistic kind of approach, because right now, besides the former child soldiers, we have children born in the LRA captivity to these young little mothers. And then we have children also who have lost parents to the LRA. So as Children of Peace Uganda, we've decided to bring all of them together because they are all directly affected. So what do we do with them? We do trauma therapy through creative art. We do drama with them. We do music. We do drawing. And in each activity, we attach a theme. In trauma therapy through art, we've divided it into about three different parts. Number one, we do emotional strength. We build their emotional strength to understand that, yes, what they have gone through, they cannot change it, but they can change the future. They have gone through so much, but they can start all over again and be able to become successful in life. And we tell them that, you know, it's going to be a gradual process. Then the second part of the trauma therapy, we do forgiveness. Because we know that if these children can't reach the point of forgiving those who have hurt them and forgiving themselves, then they cannot get the emotional healing that we are looking for. And we know that once they don't forgive, they hold the bitterness inside them and that can destroy them physically. They will develop physical complications and they can carry this forward and hurt other people. So we really emphasize on forgiveness and we tell them it's going to be gradual. The third aspect is we do what we call leadership mentorship. Our theme is raising peace ambassadors. Because to us, who can become a better peace advocate than the person who has gone through unthinkable pain? And he knows that if we didn't have this war, we would have lived maybe much better life than this. When you sit with them in our sessions and we ask them, whom do you want to become? They will tell you, I want to become a member of parliament. I want to be able to have policies, functional policies that protect children. I don't want another child to go through what I have gone through. To us, that is so much. So we know that we are mentoring young people who are going to become leaders, not only in northern Uganda, but that will affect the whole world in one way or the other. Some of them are going to be working with the UN in the near future. Some of them are going to be working maybe in some great radio stations like here, and they will be able to talk to people the value of peace. The second project that we do is education scholarships, because we know without an education, it's almost next to impossible to realize any development in the life of an individual and then in the general community. You find maybe a child was a former child soldier, is also an orphan. So if somebody does not step into their lives to support them go to school, then what becomes of them? They would keep thinking, if my father was there, if my mother was there, I would have also gone to school. And yet I know all of us, if we came together, just the little contribution from each one of us will make these children go to school. Then we have water. We're trying to partner with some organizations like the Tiva Water. It's an American-based organization that does water filters. And these water filters, definitely we give out to households, especially where these children come from. This little girl called Dilis. Dilis was abducted at the age of 8. That same night, her father was killed by the rebels. The mother was killed. They were abducted all together, and then she lost also 2 brothers to the LRA. She stayed in captivity and managed to escape. And when she comes back home, there are 3 little siblings she has to take care of. Today, she's 15 years old, but she's taking care of her 3 little siblings. They are just alone in their home. She's the head of the household. So if we're not going to step in the life of such children, what becomes of them? We give them this water filter. That means safe and clean water, which is very, very vital for their health. A water filter costs $60. And you're giving clean water to this family for the next 7 to 10 years for $60. You really see the results. They talk about it, how it has helped them. The children are no longer falling sick from worms and all this. The 4th one is we're looking at socioeconomic empowerment. Because we have these child mothers who have returned from captivity with the children. A girl is abducted at the age of 8 years. She's in captivity for 10 years or more. She has come back with 4 children born in captivity. She has not been empowered through education because she lost all the childhood, and she's here to take care of 4 children.
She's alone.
And she's alone.
She has no partner.
Uh-huh. And then, of course, also there's so much stigma attached to this, coming back with these children, because the community is not accepting them yet fully.
The children or the...
The children.
The young women.
The children that the young girls have come back with, because they feel these are children to these rebel commanders who have made us suffer so much. This is a child to Kony, because I work with girls who were given out as sex slaves to Joseph Kony himself, and they have children with him, very little nice children, and I love all of them.
And these young girls must love their children.
Yeah. And some of them honestly don't accept the children, but we teach them to love the children. How do we do this? We tell them that no single human being on this planet chooses a parent. I did not choose my mother. I didn't choose my father. Neither did you, neither did anyone on this planet. This is something that you wake up one morning and you know that's your father and that's your mother, and that is it. We can't change this. And that's exactly what has happened to these children. Whether the biological father is Joseph Kony, whether he's a prominent person in America or in Uganda, they are children. They are human beings like any other person. So we are not going to stigmatize somebody because of his parents, background or anything. We are looking at children. Our next step is have maybe some funds where we can do a radio program locally to be able to talk to the community. We want them to understand under what circumstances were these children born.
Thank you very much, Jane Akayu, for your work and for coming here to talk with us and share it with us and our listeners.
Well, thank you so much.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.